My name is David Livingston, born and raised in Montreal. I'm now living back here again after many years away. I've written five books. My most recent is called Ordo Ab Cal, and it's a, I guess it's, well, it's far more than all the research that I've done. Basically, I've been researching for basically 30 years now, and trying to understand the world we live in. And I've explored a lot of topics that are normally not covered by mainstream historians, and revealed a lot of hidden activity that puts a lot of what we know in a completely different light. So that's research that has spanned a timeline from the very beginnings of human history right up until today. And that basically resulted in four books covering most of that period. But my recent book, I basically characterize it as probably all of my other books combined probably add up to about 15% of what I've compiled in my recent book. So really my previous books really just laid the groundwork, gave me the perspective to understand and complete the story. And, you know, even though I've been studying all these years, I can't believe how many topics I had never come across before that are completely brand new, but really, for me, helped explain quite a bit about the world we're living in.
In a way, I think it'd be nice to start with the actual sort of the news on the news at the moment, which is the COVID pandemic, or questionable pandemic. I mean, there's lots of people who have questioned it. Yeah. Certainly, we're questioning it here in the UK. I've just come from the Welsh Parliament, where debate is not even allowed by lockdown skeptic members of the Welsh Parliament, banned from even speaking, let alone the idea that there might be a vote. Of course, they're with the vote, but the Neil McAvoy was actually wanted to speak on it. He wasn't even allowed to speak in the discussion and debate. So there's a lot of closing down of both mass media and what the basic normal political rights here. So can you just give us your take on what's going on? How real it is, and also evidence behind what makes you think that, whatever it is.
Well, I mean, I've had my eye on Bill Gates for a while, but he's not a person that I've studied very closely. He's never really factored in anything that I've uncovered. But when he came out, as soon as the COVID hit the news, he came out and said something like, "This is going to be the epidemic of the century," or something like that. And as soon as he said that, I knew he had to be a part of it. So I mean, it doesn't take long to look up, because you immediately find out that he was involved in various, what do they call it? I can't remember the name yet. It's not something I've studied extensively, but basically he's, of course, I mean, first of all.
Let me just intervene here a second, because there's two major things. One is the event 201, which was the pandemic exercise.
Yeah.
The other is ID 2020, which is supposed to be the solution to all of this, where we get a little kind of a pass that we can then go back to normal if we've got Bill Gates' little pass.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's quite a lot in there. He's also been involved in vaccination on a big, big scale, revealed mainly by Robert Kennedy, the Democratic senator in the UK, or whatever he is, congressman maybe, who's explained that a lot of this is basically experimenting on human beings, and much of it has been unsuccessful. So we're talking about effectively a kind of Dr. Mengele character experimenting on human beings, and yet he is kind of painted as potentially, anyway, a kind of twisted messiah by the mass media, and those that are criticizing him are being actually shut out, even experts. So that paints a little portrait of Gates, I think.
Yeah. Well, he's a very, very corrupt guy, right? I mean, he always has been. He's basically cheated his way to his wealth. You know, what's important, of course, is that he, because I wrote an article about this recently, and what's interesting is that his idol is David Rockefeller, and he was actually friends with David Rockefeller. He models his career on David Rockefeller. And what's interesting is that, two things, basically, that the Rockefeller dynasty began with John D. Rockefeller and his monopolization of the American oil industry. And that was broken apart by the Sherman Antitrust, laws. And basically, those are the same laws that were used to break up Microsoft's attempt at monopoly. And then how John D. Rockefeller basically at the end of his, how he ended his career was he took a lot of his money and basically bought his reputation back. He put his money into a number of tax-exempt foundations or charitable foundations. So the sneaky thing about it is that now he was able to spend his money on political activities and he got a tax credit for it. And Bill Gates is basically following the same scenario. So after, again, cheating his way to the top and, being basically, openly exposed as a con man, as a monopolizer, then he turns to charity and basically refurbishes his reputation. And of course, now the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is the largest charitable foundation in the world. And I think that's, that's a thing people don't seem to really think of, that a private foundation created by private citizens that has no, they're not elected, they're not in any way part of, been in any way giving any mandate from a public body, are exercising enormous influence on political, on bodies and institutions that are able to exercise and enforce decisions on the public. So I think that's the larger, that's part of the, I mean, that's how he's exercising his scheme, and how he's going to bring that about. That's a frightening thing. In fact, there's recently announced that the government of Canada bought how many millions of doses they sort of pre-ordered, and it's from a company that, of course, has had investments from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So it's just awful that a private organization like this is not being investigated for an open conflict of interest.
So the interesting thing about all this is that you're absolutely right about these monopolists. Effectively, once they control a market, like the Rockefellers or the Gates with software, with oil, they can really set the price. And this is one of the things that capitalists absolutely dream about, is to be able to control a market, be able to control the price, jack the price up however they like. What do you make of the sort of shift from the idea of controlling energy and oil to this whole IT idea? Because obviously Windows and Microsoft is a different kind of thing to the energy industry, whereas that was a commodity. This is something different, isn't it? It's more about, I suppose, controlling ideas and information than it is about just controlling oil and energy.
Well, that's precisely what makes Bill Gates suspicious. And there's two people who are basically the culprits here, and that's Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. Because this is what I show in my book, Transhumanism, is that, the plan actually goes back. People follow the history of the personal computer, but what they don't realize is that what we need to do is follow the history of artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence is what the original goal was. It wasn't just a personal computer. It's a personal computer is basically just the machine, the mechanism that is ultimately aimed at achieving artificial intelligence. And, we don't have that much time, but I don't want to go on too many tangents, but really the goal has been since probably the 40s, I'm guessing, at least, and then particularly the rise of cybernetics has been to create the all-seeing eye of Freemasonry. And this is not something I'm just saying off the top of my head. It's basically, you can go back to somebody like Norbert Wiener in his book called God and Gollum being a Kabbalistic created creature, that he compared the creation of machine intelligence to the creation of a Gollum, which is an achievement that would basically make man equal to God. And so you jump forward a couple of, before we go there, we have to see how the birth of the advent of the personal computer, how closely aligned it was with the government agenda, and closely aligned with the CIA, particularly Stanford Research Institute, which was involved in also MKUltra and Stargate program and so on and so forth. So all those activities have been very closely aligned, and most of the people who are involved in those several channels were also involved in development of the personal computer. And then, so when it came time to enable personal computers with the internet, this was clearly a project of, you know, again, the CIA, and that involved principally Google, Microsoft, and Apple. And then out of that, of course, you have all the sort of subsidiary projects like Facebook and now Instagram and probably TikTok and all these things. So, you know, the logo of the Total Information Awareness Project of DARPA really shows exactly what the intent was. And it shows an all-seeing eye casting its gaze on the globe. So all these technologies, their goal was to create an all-seeing eye that was going to be able to spy on everything. And that's basically it. So yeah.
So if you travel to one of the Orthodox countries like Greece, mm-hmm. you'll see, the all-seeing eye painted above the doorways of chapels, churches, or whatever, from hundreds and hundreds of years ago, David. Right.
Yeah, that may be, but there's, you know, a lot of symbols get used for different reasons. You'll find the swastika all over the world too, but it doesn't mean the same thing to them as it did to the Nazis, right? So the all-seeing eye is a very specific meaning to those who have used it in this particular context recently.
Okay, so with the all-seeing eye of God, this is quite interesting, isn't it? Because for centuries, probably millennia, you know, many people have thought of the idea of God as, you know, someone who's kind of watching down, almost someone who's recording events, you know. So if you do something wrong or something right, God is kind of keeping a tally of that sort of thing. Right. Whereas this seems like something rather different, where you've got a kind of camera or a satellite actually recording this rather than God. So what's the difference between the two? Why such a similar imagery?
Because it's a Tower of Babel. It's the attempt to, this is the ultimate defiance, right? The Kabbalah is founded on the belief that man can become God. That's their goal, right? Is to become, they don't believe God as an external power entity that has power over us. They believe that man can and will become God. And that's what they're trying to create. Then their vehicle is the personal computer and artificial intelligence. So when you see how it's being used, you know, now that they have this full control, not only of our data, but basically of the information that we're supplied, basically how we interpret the world, that you can see that they have. Because, you know, I was thinking as I said, we started our conversations, that I remember when the internet first came out, I heard that there had been comparisons to radio, when radio first came out. And there was this big hoopla, big optimism when the radio came out, that it was going to liberate the masses and be a democratic medium that was going to allow people to, broadcast anyone to broadcast their information. What happened is that eventually it was consolidated and then ultimately controlled. And I think most of us were enthusiastic and hopeful about the prospects of the internet, but I fear that we are witnessing the monopolization of the internet. So we're getting to the point now where you, as it was in TV before and radio before, that you've got a handful of big players that are now able to control, and they're effectively censoring dissent.
That's right. I mean, you know, certainly with monopolistic organizations like YouTube, for many, many years, people have been putting their material. I'm afraid I have to hold my hands up and say I have too on YouTube. Yeah. And it suddenly starts, you start getting skewed search results. It's the abuse of the monopoly, and I suppose that's what we've been talking about. But look, I can remember back in the mid-90s reading a book by Jim Keith, Mind Control, World Control, where it was the first time I came across this whole term of technocracy, the idea that, you know, the idea of people actually consenting would be done away with. There may actually be some sort of pretense of this, you know, sort of pantomime, which we certainly, you know, looking at much of our politics in the Western world today, certainly seems like a pantomime. So what is a technocracy? Because I know you've written about this in, you know, your book about transhumanism. I think it would be quite interesting to hear where you think, you know, what is their kind of dream? Where are they heading? Where do they want to be in a couple of years' time, David?
They want to fulfill the Book of Revelation. That's what it is. The Book of Revelation is their blueprint.
So, you know, what will that look like?
I'm not sure how they interpret it, but I mean, if you look from the point of view of transhumanism and the singularity, then it just means possibly, creating the Antichrist or creating the beast. To create a, even there's, I quote this guy in my book on transhumanism. His name is Francis Haylion, something like that. And he explains that, if you look at humanity hasn't been able to get unified on a single idea, and that, the idea of a global brain or an artificial intelligence can serve humanity as a god. And maybe he's a nut. Maybe he's a little nut. And, you know, these are ideas that are expressed in it. They line up with what they seem to be doing. If that is ultimately what their plan is, that remains to be seen.
There are some people that would say there is no such thing as artificial intelligence, and it's impossible that actually someone would always be kind of behind it, that it may actually itself be an illusion. So, you know, there's an artificial intelligence out there saying X, Y, and Z, directing things in whatever direction, but actually it's secretly controlled. I wonder what you make of that idea.
Well, the thing is that, you know, artificial, it took me a while to understand it as well, too. Artificial intelligence is not it's not creating a life, right? But it's creating a machine that can perform extraordinarily complex operations, and so it will be able to perform operations that are, I mean, you can see it happen already. The potential is pretty substantial, and especially when you have machines that learn. So it's never going to be a living being, right? But it's going to be able to perform. It's possible it will be able to perform feats that will be impressive and have possibly substantial consequences. I mean, the reality is, you know, it's like in 2001, right? In the end, you just pull the plug. it's not going to power itself. But that's not really the point, right? The point is, this is the wizard behind the curtain. You know, this is the Wizard of Oz that they're creating. It's the illusion that they want to put forth. This is the ultimate idol, the ultimate false god that they're creating.
Yeah, and what they're saying with it is that actually, look, mankind can do this. We don't need God. That sort of thing. Your book, your most recent book, Auto Abcheo. Can you just talk a bit about the title? Because I know it's associated with the Scottish Rite Freemasonry, and that is quite an interesting little institute in itself.
Absolutely.
It's particularly Albert Pike and his ideas about creating revolutions, in Russia, world wars. I mean, I don't know if he was involved in the Chinese Revolution, but he was certainly trying his very best to get conflict in the Middle East going, and that's been quite successful through the British Empire, etc. The State of Israel, like a kind of crusader state. It's almost like a throwback to the Crusades and medieval times.
Yeah.
you know, where they weren't successful back then, this is a sort of second bite of the cherry. So I wonder, you know, what made you choose that title, AutoAb KO, and you know, what do you think that represents in modern world events?
Well, because what I had suspected for a long time was that the book, not a long time, over the last few years, that the book of Revelation might be a blueprint. And I tried to research it a bit until I finally realized that I had read Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma, you know, like maybe 20 years ago, and it never hit me. And it's right there in like the first few paragraphs that the book of Revelation is, he didn't call it the blueprint, but it basically outlines the plan. This is why St. John is the patron saint of Freemasonry. And Albert Pike, and whether you agree with this, I'm not supporting his argument, but this is his perception, is that the book of Revelation is a Kabbalistic book. Right? So Albert Pike says that Kabbalah is the ancient wisdom of the ancient Magi, inherited by the Illuminati, right? Basically preserved through time through people like Plato and Pythagoras. And so, you know, Scottish Rite Freemasonry is, in fact, this is a history that I follow quite a bit. We can't go into detail here, but I've got several chapters on it and the role of Kabbalah in the development of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. So the point of Kabbalah, and really Kabbalah has several stages, but there's very important development. The most important is probably the Kabbalah by Isaac Luria. And he basically said, and this is what was important that he introduced, was that you don't wait for the Messiah to come. You have to actively exert effort and create the circumstances for his coming. So these are Luciferians. Like, I mean, Albert Pike is a Luciferian. They read everything in reverse, where, you know, like William Blake said, where you see white, I see black. And if the Book of Revelation describes chaos existing before the advent of the Messiah, well, therefore you have to sow chaos, because that chaos is required to accelerate his coming. So whatever is described, war, disease, right, famine, then you create those circumstances because they're needed for the Messiah's coming.
Well, that's fascinating, David, because, you know, we're living in the world possibly for the first time mm-hmm. in human history where we really can create global famine, global war, and these things are possible to create. But look, I mean, you know, pinning this down to being a Kabbalistic book, mm-hmm. isn't it so feasible that Pike saw this as a real revelation from God and decided that it was really important to take it and to twist it, you know, so that they could, as these events unfolded, that he believed that they would unfold. But as they unfolded, to try and twist interpretation to their own preferred version, because didn't want people reading this book of Revelation going, hey, this is what they're up to. They had quite a lot of chance to sort of twist things in their direction. And also, of course, at the end of Revelation is actually Christ comes back, you know, and then it's actually quite a positive ending, even though it's like, you know, a bit of a storm, to put it mildly. At the end of the storm, there's heaven on earth. So, I mean, how does that fit in with the, you know, Pike and this being a Kabbalistic book?
Because it's Gnostic, right? So the Gnostics read the same Bible as you do, but they read it in reverse, right? So if you believe the book of Revelation is true, then that would be one interpretation. They're reading the same book, but having the reverse impression that you are, right? So the Bible talks about, you know, Cain killing Abel, about the descent to earth of the sons of God, about the sons of Canaan, the human sacrifice and things like that, where you would see things, so those things would be, you know, interpreted to you as evil. Those to a Gnostic would be interpreted as positive. That the fallen angels were actually the true messengers who were warring against the oppressive creator God and trying to liberate humanity by teaching them magic and such things.
Well, I'm quite interested in you as a Muslim scholar looking at kind of comparison really between the Islamic interpretation of eschatology in the Quran and some of the things in Revelation and other parts of the Bible, Daniel, etc. I mean, we've got some pretty obvious figures there. There's the Antichrist and the false prophet, the idea of a sort of political leader and a spiritual leader that are fighting for the Luciferian side. But there's also the two witnesses on the side of God against, so there are kind of parallels between the two. But there are all sorts of things in there. I just wonder if you have teased out from looking at Revelation, any kind of parallels between what Muslims have seen, Jews and Christians as, what may transpire.
Well, I mean, there's a few points. So the thing is that I don't know how it took. I only realized it recently, but I didn't realize that the Nazi Millennial Reich was also based on Revelation as well, indirectly. I mean, so is the New Age movement, right? New Age movement is based on the Book of Revelation as well, too. So the Book of Revelation basically is the fundamental underlying blueprint for the occult agenda. And the thing is, I do see it in Islam, and there's no doubt about it. It's prevalent, and is the fact is that in Islam it's almost a mirror image of the Christian account. So there's Jesus returns, and there's a great war, and the Antichrist appears, and he's defeated. Then there's a 1,000-year reign, right? All those elements are there, but the problem is that that is being used to the problem is how people interpret. There's people, frankly, what I'm witnessing is that people are too anxious. They're looking forward to seeing the end times. They want to see it be manifested, and that the danger is because it's almost like there's an impatience there that they're trying to appease and almost like a way of confirming their beliefs. And the problem is that, and I argue about this with Muslims, is that those end times prophecies are not there to guide your actions. They are there. They will be confirmed after they happen. So that's why one guy in particular that I talk about, because we talked about Alexander Dugin. So Dugin is a key architect here. And this is why he is basically creating the mirror image of the clash of civilization by trying to unite what he calls Eurasia. And because he says in his own words that the end times is not just a prophecy, it's a task. Right? So he's literally going about trying to actualize the end times. And part of that is by pitting West against East. the Atlanticism against Eurasianism, to use his language. And so part of that scheme is to use Islamic quote-unquote eschatology for those purposes, because they are mirror images of themselves. And I'm sorry to say, it's rather easy to mislead both Christians and Muslims. There's enough indications to make it seem like several of these prophecies are coming true, and they're lining those people up directly for an artificial confrontation.
Yeah, I think, I mean, they've realized that there's an enormous flexibility in the interpretation of these things, especially as much of it is kind of imagery which could be taken one way or another. And there's been an enormous effort, certainly through things like the Scofield Bible, to create this idea of a rapture, where God is going to whisk all the Christians away and they're not going to have to suffer at all. The point of that really being to, when things get tough and they're not whisked away, this is an enormous, kick in the teeth for the Christians who are expecting God would do this for them. So there's quite a lot of psychological stuff in there.
Right. So I've got some very important findings in my latest book, because I hit at it on my previous books, but I've explored it much with much further detail. So it's actually, what were just suspicions before are now almost proven. So basically what's fascinating is that the evangelical movement in particular was heavily influenced by Count Zinzendorf. And Count Zinzendorf basically is the founder of the Moravian Church, and who was basically in a Sabbatian and Rosicrucian front. They organized, they exercised a profound influence on the revivalist movement in the United States. And that's another tangent. In fact, what's interesting, there's a revivalist movement was very much behind abolitionism in the United States, pitted against the pro-slavery movement, which was very much spearheaded by Skull and Bones and the Ku Klux Klan, of which Albert Pike was involved. But that's another tangent. But I also trace then the more modern development of the evangelical movement, particularly early Christian Zionist movement, and its very close association with Sabbateans and Zionists, and very suspiciously, the Golden Dawn. Like, to give you a hint, to give you a clue, the Golden Dawn, sorry, the Dracula, Bram Stoker, who wrote Dracula, he was a member of the Golden Dawn, and it was based on the vampire culture of the area of Transylvania. His main advisor was a Hungarian scholar whose name was Armin van Bury. He was not only one of the key founders of Pan-Turkism, which was also a Sabbatian movement, but also of the Shambhala myth. And he was a friend of Theodor Herzl.
Yeah, the Zionist, the number one Zionist. Also, I mean, I've been reading recently, David, Roland Perry's book, The Fifth Man, on Victor Rothschild, because he was been an incredibly important figure right the way, before World War II, through World War II, and after, through into the creation of the State of Israel and all that. But he was incredibly clever at hiding, basically up until he died, his role, feeding as much information as Stalin wanted. I mean, Stalin was finding out British secrets before even Churchill was. That's how successful Victor Rothschild had been. So, what about this family? I mean, we hear all sorts of conspiracy theories about them, and in fact, I think some of them are seeded erroneous theories in order to try and discredit people who will just pick them up and believe they're true. There's actually quite a lot of effort goes into this. But what do you make of the Rothschilds and the various houses? Because their role in creating the State of Israel, the coming potential war between Iran and Israel in the Middle East, which, this is one of the reasons I think people do look at Revelation in a positive way, is they're saying, well, look, this looks like it's coming. At least we need to be prepared in some way as to deal with this rather than just have it hit us like a tsunami. So what do you make of the Rothschilds' role?
Well, I mean, they played an important role. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it's hard to interpret exactly what their role is because they're not the only ones. And they succeeded. They were pretty successful in not hiding their, I guess keeping their being fair, they were pretty discreet. If that's the word. So, they had a very close relationship with the family.
Hang on, because the thing about Victor Rothschild, he was anything but. He was right in the middle of the secret services in World War II. Obviously the public didn't know what he was up to, but the top people did. And then afterwards he was part of the Edward Heath government, the Harold Wilson government in the it was basically called the Central Policy Review Star, the think tank that took an enormous role both in policy towards Israel and other sorts of foreign policy, but most importantly, appointing the heads of the secret services and things like that. So, I suppose, that in that way, we only know this now. So in a way, you're absolutely right. You know, at the time, no one was aware that either that he was a spy for Stalin for Israel. And really, his main object was to help create the state of Israel.
Yeah.
And that we only know now what he was up to.
Yeah. Well, for a large part of the last couple of hundred years, their role is pretty discreet. Where the actions of people associated with them are a little more obvious. Like if you look at the Zionist movement, the Rothschilds, Rabbi Altman was pretty great source. He identified the Rothschilds as Sabbateans, but there's only a few families that are because the survival of the Sabbatean movement is something that's contested by various cults, right? They basically say the movement disappeared. There's only a handful of people who are known to have been Sabbateans. And the thing is that they were all key people in the key families in the rise of the Zionist movement. And that's particularly the Warburgs, Jacob Schiff, Judge Brandeis, Samuel Untermeyer, Felix Frankfurter, and Rabbi Stephen Wise. And so if you follow the actions of those several people, you'll see that they were basically the founding fathers of the modern Zionist movement. And with some discreet relationship, again, with the Rothschilds. Also, a very close relationship with Aleister Crowley and his OTO. Samuel Untermeyer, in particular, was a member of the OTO.
One of the things I was listening to you recently talking about, which I found quite interesting, was the whole idea of the Royal Society creating the Darwinistic ideas and the theosophists then coming along at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century to sort of fill that gap. So I wonder if you could just take us through that a bit, because I think for many people, nowadays in school, the theory, so-called, of evolution is taught as fact. And, this, to me, needs a little bit of taking apart. In fact, if you talk to many teachers directly, one-to-one, they'll say, well, I think that both should be taught. But the thing is, they're not anymore. And so what do you make of the role of Darwin, the Royal Society, and the Theosophists?
So I've got a whole chapter called God is Dead, which looks at all the connections between the Darwin's family, the Huxleys. The Huxleys were involved in X Club. Darwin's grandfather was a member of the Lunar Society with Benjamin Franklin. The Lunar Society included a number of people who were prominent Illuminati, like John Priestley, most importantly. They were all connected to a network called Johnson Circle, I think is what it was. Joseph Johnson, who was a publisher, he basically connected people like Mary Wollstonecraft, her husband William Godwin, their daughter Mary Shelley Wollstonecraft, who's the author of Frankenstein, and their friend Lord Byron, who was a member of Carbonari. Mary Shelley was obviously married to Percy Shelley, who is a Rosicrucian. These are all people who had evident and extensive connections, basically, to the Illuminati of their time. And they were out to destroy the idea of God. And so Darwin was just another example. And the idea of evolution, again, is basically borrowed from Lurianic Kabbalah. The thing is that, the Illuminati in general, basically, they're perceived as being anti-God or atheist. And even like the Enlightenment is presented today as an anti-religious movement, but it was fundamentally a Gnostic, Luciferian movement. It's not that they didn't believe in God or religion, it's that they believed in the opposite of it. So they were opposed to the idea of God, not so much any kind of religious belief, because all the people who were the main forefather, the main underlying ideologues of the Enlightenment were all secretly occultists. So,
actually, hang on, I think we need to untangle that a little bit. So, is the idea, do you think, that it was they believed in a god, just not the god of the Bible, or what?
Yes, they're probably Luciferian, so they believed in, they believed like Gnostics did do, that that Lucifer is the true god, and they basically just take him, put everything in reverse, and of course then they believe along with everything else, which is like magic and astrology and spirit communication and all.
Okay, so the idea of God to them, mm-hmm. is basically the idea that humanity should be absolutely free to do whatever it wants without limits, right. And that's what God wants. Is that in a nutshell? Is that, do you think I'm on the right track there?
Absolutely, and that's basically the idea of rights that they created, right? So, and that's the idea of reason. That's so, you know, that because they believe that there's no logical argument for the existence of God, so they called it irrational and a superstition. So again, so by basically to the public who were unaware of their true affiliations, this was perceived as a successful attack against religion, and the average person then associated all religion with superstition and even any belief in the supernatural at all. And that's, so as I said last time, that's what opened the groundwork for people like it's a perfect Hegelian dialectic, right? It's a false it's a straw man argument, right?
So the idea is you destroy the idea of God and then you replace it with your idea of God somehow, you know, you fill the gap. Yes, quite clever, isn't it? Listen, if people are interested in just kind of getting to grips with some of this, I think the most important thing you talked about at the start is the getting an idea of a timeline here, you know, tracing through history and finding actually quite a lot of what we've been told, you know, never mind the kings and queens and things like that, isn't really getting to the heart of how we got where we are today. Which of your books do you think you would recommend to kind of get to grips with the misinterpretation of history? I think this is one of the things I found so fascinating and rather endeared me to George Orwell, is this whole thing about he who controls the present controls the past, he who controls the present. Actually, no, it's the past controls the present. The present controls
the present past. Goes on the past.
Sorry, do you want to say it for us?
Yeah, he who controls the present controls the past.
And he who controls the past controls the future. So, you know, this idea, whereabouts, it was almost like a sort of point to start at to try and come to grips with this, because, you know, you can dive into these specific individual things, but I think you're only kind of going to get anywhere once you've got the whole picture. So whereabouts have you done that, David?
My latest book. It's the one that offers the most comprehensive picture. All my previous books are... The core ideas are brought into the latest one and to basically substantiate the latest one. And I build on it extensively more than what I've covered before. So it's called Ordo Ab Cow, and it's at ordoabcow.ca. It's gigantic. It's in 6 volumes, and it covers it's all broken up into chunks. So it covers the ancient times, the development of Kabbalah, the Sufism, the rise of the Holy Grail, what's new is the Order of Christ and the Order of Santiago, which I cover, which is really essential because it's important to understand the rise of Ferdinand and Isabella and their role in the development of the creation of the Muranos and their discovery of the New World, because the New World is basically, that is the ultimate Rosicrucian plot. The creation of America was a new Rosicrucian plan, following Bacon's New Atlantis, right down to the idea promoted by Manly P. Hall that the creation of democracy is the furtherance of the so-called great work, the magnum opus of the Freemasonry. I trace the rise. I have a lot more on the Rosicrucians just to really see where, what their sources were, what their true origins were, how they really set the stage for the emergence of the British royal family, the emergence of Freemasonry, how the close alignment of Freemasonry and Kabbalah, their development of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, particularly in the United States, their association, their affiliation with the Reform movement of Judaism and its evolution into Zionism. Then in modern times, the relationship between Zionists and the OTO, their collaboration there and their development of the far right, particularly, you know, the funded and orchestrated through British intelligence that worked its way through Russia and then through through Nazi Germany, which appears to have been largely a British intelligence mission, which and then the ongoing influence of fascism, which basically exploded into the Fascist International, which evolved into the Gladio operation, Iran-Contra, the various right-wing elements in the United States, like the John Birch Society, most recently the Council for National Policy, and then finally Donald Trump.
Okay. Well, one thing, we interviewed a chap recently here, Philip Beale. He's an ex-Royal Navy officer, and he got kind of disillusioned with the Navy, really, in that he had a romantic idea of being a sailor and, you know, doing great things. And when he retired, well, he retired early and got into the City of London, made some money and built the first ever Phoenician ship that was actually built in Cyprus. And then the end of last year, actually, after having circumnavigated Africa in this Phoenician design, basically, ship, square rigged, you know, none of the advanced ideas of the sorts of sails that you need to sail against the wind and that sort of thing.
Right.
And he proved really in November, December that it was actually, and I asked him, I said, you know, what was it like crossing the Atlantic? Mm-hmm. In this Phoenician ship, and he said, well, that was actually, it was really easy, no problem, you know. And he got a bit of a rude reception in Florida.
Right.
He told them that actually Columbus wasn't a great guy. He was, you know, sort of actually a criminal, and he was thrown out of the Miami Yacht Club. He wasn't allowed to stay there. But anyway, I just wonder what you make of the role of the Phoenicians. We still think in Europe, I think, that they had quite an important influence right up to use of the, you know, developing the modern alphabet. The idea of using sounds rather than sort of hieroglyphic symbols was quite important. And also the ruins of Scandinavia do look very much like these Phoenician symbols. Yeah. Britain apparently was named Britain after the tin that the Phoenicians were trading from Britain. And also they had a big influence on our pagan culture, pre-Christian culture here through, well, at least that's one of the interpretations of Stonehenge, is that you had a kind of original Stonehenge. And then when the Phoenicians came along, there was a kind of a bigger Stonehenge, which involved human sacrifice. But what do you make of the Phoenicians? What's their role? Because they are sort of almost buried in history. And I think there's one of those phoenixes, for example, on Bill Gates and his ID 2020 conference that he held, a giant phoenix kind of sitting there on the side. If you look not too closely, it looks like a Christ figure. But actually, you look a little bit more closely on a cross, you know, it's actually a phoenix. And we have here, just down the road from us, here in Gloucestershire, in Tetbury, where Prince Charles has his residence at Highgrove, a giant pillar with a phoenix on it. So what do you make of these guys? Because this is quite a powerful symbol, isn't it? The phoenix rising from the ashes. And how does that fit into history, do you think?
Well, it's crucial. So I discussed the Phoenicians extensively in my book, The Dying God. So basically, there's a marked period of Near Eastern influence in Greek civilization that happens in the classical period, particularly with the advent of philosophy. But there's also an important influence, well, you mentioned it, in archaic Greece, and that's marked by the influence of the Phoenicians. And that's why, as you mentioned, our alphabet, even our modern alphabet, is descended from Phoenician, not the language, but the letters, because only the letters were adopted, which is ultimately a Semitic language, which is why it's effectively the same alphabet as you find in Hebrew and Arabic. So there's a couple of important books there's that highlight in extensive detail the role, the foundational role of Phoenician influence on Greek culture. One of them is called One of them by Walter Mercurt. I can't remember the title. The other one's called East Face of Helicon by M.L. West. And, I mean, these books are gigantic. They're about, like, 600 pages long, and that's how much detail they're able to offer. The East Face of Helicon is called that because he isolates the influence on Greek culture, not the Middle East in general, but specifically the area of Palestine. So the thing is that Herodotus himself described the Phoenicians as coming from Egypt and practicing circumcision. So that parallels the account of Exodus. And the thing is, there's also, I use it as a source in my book, a book by Raphael Patai. He's a famous Jewish scholar. It's called Ancient Jews and Seafaring or something like that. It basically shows that the Bible refers to the tribe of Dan as, so each tribe had that kind of, area of activity, and the tribe of Dan was associated with shipping or the ocean. So he suggests that, so basically if you put the two and two together, because at that time in when the Israelites were living in Palestine and parts of Phoenicia, of course, they would have probably been indistinguishable from this quote-unquote Phoenicians because they were not practicing Jews. And that account is clear from the Bible that even Solomon's temple itself was used as a cult of pagan ritual. So the practice of Judaism itself was only held among a very small minority. And otherwise, in terms of cult, the practice of the large people of the majority number of Israelites would have been identical to that of the Canaanites, which basically the worship of Baal and Astarte and so on and so forth. And so it would appear that all the evidence suggests that there was that the Phoenicians effectively founded Greece. And there are enough Greek myths to support it because you have several founding myths in Greece. And they're like the founding myths of the Danaans in particular. So that could be, again, I mean, it's a little bit more remote, but it could be referring to tribe of Dan, but they apparently come from Egypt. And I can't remember the details, but basically they are said to come from Egypt and somewhere in there it's the daughter of Phoenix or something like that. So even Greek mythology traces the origin of the Danaans as well as the Dorians, because the Dorians were known as sons of Heraclid, if I remember correctly, and that would be Hercules, which is basically the Greek version of Baal. So and there's other accounts too. That I think is Hecateus of Abdera. He basically said something to the effect that a number of Jews, Israelites, left with Moses and settled in Greece and in Palestine and another remnant ended up in founded Greece. Right. Those are the details I can remember off the top of my head.
Okay, well, that's very well done. But, I mean, this doesn't put a very good spin on the Jerusalem temple, does it? You know, built exactly. Originally by Phoenicians. Right. And this is held up as a very, very important thing. I mean, even going right back to the English Civil War and Cromwell's day, he was waving, the idea of rebuilding a temple around those that were eventually to end up being the regicides that killed right. the English king, Charles I, and some would say that was some kind of coven or lodge that he created in order to carry out that, because he knew, Cromwell knew, that unless he killed the king, that the king would be coming for him after the war. So I just wonder what you make of that, because it's not, you know, the temple is held up as something very important, very wonderful, and one can understand to most Jews it is, but you know, what you're saying there is suggesting maybe it isn't such a fantastic place, and it might have connotations which many even Jews don't realize.
Well, I believe it was originally good, and I believe that you know, Solomon was actually a righteous prophet, but it's he was misappropriated. So this, I mean, that's the whole foundation of Freemasonry, right? Is basically that it's preserving the wisdom of Solomon, particularly with regards to architecture, because of his construction of the temple. So the reconstruction of the temple, hence the Templars, serves as an allegory for the construction of the New World Order. But they also expect that the Third Temple is to be constructed, because that's a fundamental component of the arrival of the Messiah. But you know, the whole temple mysticism is core to the Kabbalah. It all goes back to the visions of Ezekiel and the Merkabah mysticism, which is basically the core of the Kabbalah.
Fascinating. Just remind us whereabouts we can find you online, David.
Right. So I at my website, which is ordoabcowell.ca. If you Google ordoabcowell.
Do you want to just run through the books once more?
My previous books would be The Dying God, Hidden History of Western Civilization, Terrorism and Illuminati, 3,000 Year History, Black Terror, White Soldiers, and Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. And my most recent is Ordo Abcal.
David Livingstone, thanks for your patience. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me again, Tony.